is an oral history session being conducted by David Silver and Irv Pollack. And we are at Irv Pollack's office at 1200 19th Street in Washington, D.C. That is sufficient introduction. It is January 16th, 2002. Okay, Irv, starting at the beginning, why and when did you go to work for the SEC?
I went to work at the SEC in October of 1946. And I came there because my brother, who had started in the SEC many years before the war, told me that it was a great place for lawyers, and all the lawyers he knew were ecstatic about their ability to operate and the challenges they were able to handle at the SEC. So I took an exam, which was an oral exam, and I was interviewed by a board which included somebody like Milton Cole and some others. And I was able, apparently, to satisfy them that I had the qualities or the qualifications. And so I received an offer for them and joined the commission, as I said, in October of 46. One interesting thing in that is I came from a non-high-respected law school, Brooklyn Law School, and the general counsel's office in which I was offered the position had mostly people from the elite law schools in the country. The reason they were interested in me is that I had been asked whether I would be willing to work on criminal matters, and I said I would. Apparently, the others in the office who came from the other schools felt that criminal cases were not really the kinds of things they wanted to work on. They were all excellent appellate lawyers. They were fantastic people who had great abilities and talent. So it was just that odd circumstance that permitted me to get into the general counsel's office, which was a very small office of about 10 or 11 lawyers.
Had the commission moved back to Washington by that time?
No. We were in Philadelphia, where we stayed until January of 1948. So I spent a year or so in Philly and then came to Washington in 1948.
You were in the service before you came?
I was in the service before that, and I had been in the eminent domain practice. And when I went back after the war to work in the firm I had been a clerk at before I got admitted in 1942, I just felt that it wasn't the kind of practice. So that was the reason I was most attracted to the SEC.
You mentioned your brother. When did Harry start working at the SEC?
About 1934 or 35. And he started, it's interesting, his career as a mimeograph operator, as I recall. And went to night school and got a degree in accounting, and eventually was put into the personnel office when, I think at my time of joining the commission, he might have been an assistant director or something. He ultimately, as you know, became director of that division and had a fabulous career at the SEC. I received, after he died, many unsolicited letters from people who said how their careers had been enhanced by the advice and assistance that he had given them in their own careers at the SEC. So he typified, I think, the SEC's early entrance into trying to help the underprivileged and the minorities. I think we were leading people in that area, and that permeated all through my career as well as his.
What would you say, when you joined the commission, what was the major emphasis of the commission's work at that time?
There were two primary areas. One was the Public Utility Holding Company Act, where the constitutionality had been sustained by the Supreme Court, as I recall, in 1938, I believe. And the commission was engaged in really making that act work. And you may recall it was referred to as the death sentence for public utilities. Turned out that under the SEC's wise administration of it, it turned out to be the saving grace for the public utilities and made them really into blue chips securities. The way they did that was to use Section 11E of the Public Utility Holding Company Act which permitted the companies themselves to come in with voluntary reorganization plans. And while I wasn't directly involved in that, I recall them saying that they used to go into meetings and say to these people, now you made these complicated structures. You created these complexities previously in order to fulfill your objectives, which was to make it so that the states couldn't understand what they were doing and defeat their ability to do effective rate regulation. Now that you've done that, you've got the genius and ability to come up now with a workable new utility company that can really accomplish the objectives that will fulfill the public policies that this act was intended to fulfill. And so that's what happened. And even in my time, just as I started, there was heavy emphasis on that. The second one, and also very prominent, was the registration process. The commission itself reviewed every registration statement that was filed. And they spent a great deal of time in trying to improve disclosure aspects of that, stop water proceedings were brought to attempt to protect the process from being corrupted by con men and other people who were trying to use it to accomplish fraud.
Who was the general counsel when you came to work?
Roger Forster. And I should take a moment to say that I think all the lawyers I've known in my life, I would say he probably would stand out as being one of the top three lawyers, and that includes people like Abe Fortas, who became a Supreme Court Justice. Roger Forster had the innate ability to take the most complicated kinds of factual situations and get to the core of the problem quickly. People who worked with him more intimately than I did, and I did work with him on occasion, which I'll mention later, said that you could go into Roger, present the issue to him, and he would then think for a moment and start to speak. And if you took down what he said and just broke it up with comments and periods, you pretty much had a brief that you could file without any further drafting revisions. He was a remarkable person in that, as brilliant as he was, that's how reserved he was. I remember when I brought my fiancée, my now wife, to meet him, I thought he was embarrassed in that meeting. He was so reserved when he had that sort of thing. But he was a person just as reserved he was. That's how loyal, that's how friendly he was to every individual that knew him. And I knew him well, because later on he came back to work for me in the 1960s during Manny Cohn's administration. So I should take a moment to say that the remarkable thing about the SEC was its personality. The people that I worked with from the very beginning, in my view, were geniuses. I remember being interviewed by a life insurance agent who said to me, what grade do you think you'll be 10 years from now so I can tell you what kind of policy you're going to take? And I said, really, I'm not going to be too far from where I am. I said, you don't know this place. They are all geniuses here. And there's no chance that I could ever compete in that arena. And the second thing that came into play is, remember, the agency was formed during really the Depression. And so many of these outstanding people who couldn't find jobs elsewhere came to the SEC, and they, security was the most important thing for them. So as brilliant and as competent they were, they remained at the agency. So for take one example, we had the most outstanding oil engineer in the country, Tell White. He was so respected by the industry, nobody would ever challenge anything in terms of his knowledge and capacity. And there are reams of stories you could tell about his activities at some points. Unfortunately, we don't have a whole oral history of him as an individual. Same thing with the mining engineer. He was also a very expert guy who the commission had for many years.
Who was the chairman when you joined the commission?
When I joined the commission, let me make sure now who that was. I think it was Caffrey. My recollection is, was he the fellow that came out of New York? Do you remember?
Do you remember any of the other commissioners at that time? Philadelphia.
Yes, Conahee is the one that sticks in my mind. who later became an acting chairman, a very competent guy. I don't remember the others. And partially that's due to the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, the criminal work was sort of a subsidiary thing to the commission. I might take a moment to describe why that was so. The commission had hundreds of cases it was bringing criminally as well as civilly, but they were all in the regions. The commission had chosen principally former assistant U.S. attorneys or district attorneys who had that kind of practice and put them in as charge of the regions. And in the area of enforcement, the regions were pretty much omnipotent. They didn't really have much oversight from the Home Office of Law, except in the criminal area. In the criminal area, in order to protect the statutes from not being misapplied or to create unfortunate decisions in the courts, there was a formal criminal reference program. And that was principally the duty that I performed under Milton Crowley, who was my supervisor.
So the work of the General Counsel's Office at that time was mainly appellate,
administrative, some administrative law stuff that they handled. But most of the litigation was outside. I can't remember. If they had a proxy case, they might have had that here in the Home Office. They might have conducted that. But basically, the work of the General Counsel's Office, which only had 11 lawyers in it, and that included me, was principally handling the appellate stuff. There was still a public utility litigation. There was another field that they were very active in that I should have mentioned. That was Chapter 10. That was a big part of it. They spent a lot of time in the reorganization area because that was an area that was fairly corrupt before the commission was able to get into it. Bankruptcy was an area that, since there was nobody protecting the pot, people would be vultures and take advantage of it. So the commission was in that area very heavily in an attempt to correct that.
In the field, there was injunctive proceeding, for example, and then it was appealed. Did the Home Office get into it at that phase, even for the civil
yes.
case?
Home Office would get into it on refund.
In the early days of your career, what are the specific, if you recall, or significant actions or cases that you were on the criminal side in which you participated or have knowledge?
One of the significant cases which we lost in a criminal prosecution in the Southern District was a case involving Serge Rubenstein. It was a large-scale manipulation in New York, and the case was tried by the U.S. Attorney's Office there and lost because of the then practice of the U.S. Attorney's Offices of not having full-time employees. The lawyers were part-time practitioners who also practiced privately. And so the failure to apply themselves completely caused, I think, in my view, the loss of what was a pretty open and shut manipulative case that this guy had engaged in without getting into the facts which you can find in the annual reports of the commission. I can't remember the name of the case, but the most important thing we were able to accomplish is justice did not have the ability to direct the Southern District of New York on what it should do or not do. Therefore, it was very difficult to get that office to prosecute the criminal case. The Rubenstein case was a notorious case with these employees. Tully Kosak of the Department of Justice, who was in charge of the court section at that time, was very open and friendly to us at the SEC. And so we were able to convince him that we should be able to go to the Southern District of New York and see whether we could get them to take on our case. And the reason they didn't like the security cases is statistically they could prosecute all these other crimes, drug crimes, tax crimes, and they get credit back in the Home Office
but they tried an SEC case, even a smaller one. It required such a degree of manpower that they didn't want to do it. So what I did is I visited the office, and they had a managing attorney who carried over despite the political changes. I just don't recall his name.
But you're talking now the early 50s? Or?
I'm talking now in the, yes, in the 50s. The office operated politically. When there was a change in administration, there'd be a change in the U.S. attorney, and there would be a constant new people taking over all the cases, etc. So it was a great turnover. The individual who managed the office was a very respected attorney, very highly regarded by the judges. We spoke with him off the record, ex-party, because they had great confidence in him. And so I personally, in this case, spent time up there talking to him until, I guess, he felt I was such a pest that he agreed to take a case. And I don't remember the name of the case, but fortunately it was a successful case. They got a great deal of publicity on it, and that opened up that office to our ability to do that. And now jumping ahead a little bit, the big impetus came after the Ray case.
So we'll get to that later.
So we discussed that. But in the beginning, it was that opening up. I think the second thing that I ought to mention is that, as I mentioned earlier, the regional offices really did the cases, and then they'd send in a criminal reference report to be reviewed by somebody in St. Louis. What we tried to do then was not just to say, you don't have a case here, you don't have this, but to try and service them from the office. So what I started to do was I read every federal report, criminal case, and I would make notes of them. And the West Publishing Company had a lousy note system. Of course, it only covered legal items. But you would find a case, for example, that would say, if you go after all older people, that's an additional fraud. Now, you couldn't find that in the index, but I would make a note of that on a card. And so we developed a card file. And as the people in the field became more comfortable with us in the home office, that we were not trying to second-guess them, we were not trying to obstruct them, we were really trying to help them, they would call in when they had trials and say, look, the judge says we can't put this in. Do you have any case that we can give? And so we'd look at the cards, might find something in there. Let's say, cite this case to the court. So we developed a relationship with the field that was very good, and that became very critical, as I'll get to later on when we get into a national enforcement program.
Was the U.S. attorney in New York that time, Paul Williams, or his predecessor?
I can't remember.
And was the assistant you worked with, was that Phil Marlowe, or was he late?
He's late.
He's late.
No, it's Phil Marlowe. It is Marlowe. Yeah. It is Marlowe. Yes, Marlowe was the guy.
I know he was the
he was the guy.
The civil servant that
yes.
went through the administration.
He was the guy that went through. It was Marlowe. Yes. Yeah. And, you know, he later, you know, I became great friends with him. And so when he would make a talk, he would say, you know, it was because of his standing at my door all the time that we got this relationship. Oh, you're right, it was Phil Marlowe. But Williams was the U.S. attorney, I don't remember. But when we get to set up the office up there for fraud, that, the judge who came down here, and I can't remember his name.
When the regional offices, when you came in and into the 50s, what was the relationship between the regional offices and the home offices? For example, the regional director, did he report directly to the commission, or was there any control on the staff level? How did it work?
In practice, there was no control. They were really independent operators. You know the story of two guys going down into the Atlanta region and not reporting to that to Bill Green, the regional administrator. You know that story?
No.
The two people from the home office went down to do an investigation. I don't remember who they were, and this occurred before my time, so I only know vicariously. And they went to a brokerage out there. And in the Atlanta region, they didn't know from a home office, Washington, SEC. All they knew was Bill Green was the regional administrator. I learned that from a story I can tell you later. So the broker calls the Atlanta office and gets a hold of Bill Green and says, we have two fellas down there, whoever they were, and they say they're from the SEC. And so Bill Green says, who are they? Never heard of them. Throw them out. Call the police. And that's exactly what he did, because he had a rule, you can't go down to his area unless you tell him. He was probably the most, how shall I say, dominant guy there, and he ran really a fiefdom. Mm-hmm. So if you called him and you got to know him, I'll tell you later, in 1954 I went down there after we had established a more servicing relationship. He asked me to go down and assist in the trial of a con man in Atlanta, and did that, not because so much he wanted the assistance, as he wanted me to get out there to see what the problems were and what the difficulties were. So I spent 6 weeks in Atlanta on a trial, having convicted the guy for it. But that was the kind of individual that Bill Green was. And that was true in the other areas. There was very little, maybe in the broker-dealer area, there would be service a little bit more.
Boston, I was trying to remember, as he was speaking, there was the regional administrator left for a long, long time.
Judge Allred in Fort Worth was there for years. They were all, well, you had here in Washington, Kelly, Russ Kelly. And in those days, incidentally, the commission investigated people. Normally worked in duos. It was always a couplet. For example, the famous couplet was Eddie Eggerman and Tim Callahan. It was in Washington, Russ Kelly, and Duncan. So they had this operation, and they were terrific trial people. I mean, Kelly was probably one of the most excellent trial people I ever knew. Could have the innate ability to take a file that he'd never seen before, that Duncan had prepared, because there was such a symbiotic relationship. He knew exactly how Duncan operated, and Duncan knew how he operated. They would go into court, And Kelly would not have prepared. He just opened up the file and started his case. And he had a famous case in Florida, I remember, where the clerk said to him, you're not going to convict this guy. It was a broker dealer case, and they've got a markup case, one of those things. And he said to the clerk, if I haven't convinced you the first day that we have a case, we're going to win, I'll buy you dinner. And of course, that's what happened. He was just a fantastic guy. And that was an ability that he had that was essential, because if you went into a southern court and you came from Washington, there was an antipathy toward you. For example, when I was in Atlanta in the six-week trial, I stayed completely anonymous. I sat there, but I was not known to anybody in the jury that this guy came from Washington or something you avoided.
I was under the impression, I think maybe I heard it, staff, that in the early days a lot of the investigative personnel came from the alcohol and tax prohibition days, and that was repealed.
Didn't know that.
That's where Tim Callahan came from.
Gee, you know, as well as I knew Tim, I never asked him where he came from. That's incredible. I never knew that. And it's probably logical, because they pick people like the U.S. Attorney for as well.
We mentioned who the chairman was back then, but when you come to the 50s, who were the chairman that you remember best? Irv, we were just talking off the record when we went to take this telephone call, and we were talking a little bit more about the regents, and I think you mentioned how strong the regional administrators were, and you just mentioned some of the names of the long-term regional administrators who seemed to stay there. The administrations would come and go, chairman would come and go, but these regional administrators stayed on and on. You might mention the name of some of these.
Judge Allred in Fort Worth, Phil Kendrick in Boston, Don Stocking in Denver, Tom Hart in Chicago,
David, I can't remember whether I...
New York? Let's see.
New York, you see, Capri came here. The New York regional administrators were appointed to commission some of them because of their political connections, probably. The other thing I want to mention, well, I mentioned political, is that in my years, it was not a political agency. It was Roosevelt's favorite agency, and he pretty much told everybody to stay away from the SEC and not attempt to interfere in its work. I think it was considered his, one of his jewels in terms of that. So the agency never, I never knew who anybody's political affiliations were, nor did they know what mine were. And interesting as an aside, people didn't even know that I was related to my brother until many years later. They never made the connection, even though we had the same name. Unusual as that might be, but it might be typical of the way the agency never looked at those things.
We were also talking a little bit about the chairman, and we've come to the shift in the balance between the regional office and home offices. But has the role of the chairman changed during the period that you were at the SEC?
I would think so. I would think in the early days, excluding the very early days of Kennedy, Douglas, that taking that early period out, I think the chairman there were very, very instrumental. Douglas was a very important person in the development of the early days of the SEC when they were laying the groundwork really for the enforcement of the statutes. I think it was critical to have a person like him. And they had, for example, Frank was on one of the boards, and then they had Pecora.
Jerome Frank.
They had Pecora. They had really a very strong commission. I wasn't there, but I learned from history of people that were talking to me about it, how impressive they had. There was one person who went on to become Henderson, became the OPA. But they had a very good group of commissioners. And so in those early days, it was very critical. After I joined in 1946, I don't have that impression of the commission being that critical. I think the staff at that point was, as I said before, fabulous. They had such tremendous quality of people that you really didn't have to do much. The staff was really moving the things in these areas, whether it was registration or whether it was broker-dealers. They were establishing the principles for shingle theory, for the markups, for the self-regulation. All of that was pretty much being generated by the staff. And the, as I said before, the regions were very effective in going after all these local crime things and also establishing criminal principles in the area of fraud, etc., in the prosecution of the boiler rooms, which was a big element then.
But has there been any change? I realize, of course, that chairmen differ from each other, problems differ from generation to generation. But has there been any change or shift in what you might call the institutional role of the chairman of the SEC, vis-a-vis his fellow commissioners, control over the operations of the agency?
Yeah, I think that the chairman has become more dominant in his leadership role, particularly in recent years. I think if you go back to the Carey day and the Cohn days and the Garrett days and Budge, even Judge Budge, and Casey, Casey was a very dominant person and probably started what I would think was the control of the chairman over the agenda and really in the policies of the commission more. People like Carey, because of their personal abilities and their personality, were able to exercise effective policy moves on the part of the commission. So with Carey coming in, you have a much more intensive participation in the strategy and policy movements of the commission. And then, of course, you have under Manny Cohn at that period, which was very effective. So that period was a
period of great activity, really greatly influenced from the top of, by the commission. And then in Judge's time, Judge Budge's time, he came, remember, from Idaho. And so he had a feel for the smaller person and the smaller broker-dealer, and that was helpful because he was emphasizing, you know, go after the big guys. Little guys can't do that much damage. The big guys are the ones to do. So that Western philosophy was helpful, and Budge was a very decent individual. And indeed, when I was nominated for the commission and people were trying to submarine that appointment, he went to his former congressional group that was headed, I forget the name of it, Pat Ford was one of the members of it, to dissipate that kind of thing. Stanley was the person who told me about that. I didn't directly participate in it, but Stanley apparently got Judge Budge appointed with that kind of thing. And Casey, of course, had an ability to use other people's brains. He picked on people to try and do that. And he came in, you remember, under a cloud that he wasn't going to do a good job, and came out pretty much being recognized as having tried to do a good job.
Since we're on the, you mentioned the chairman, if you had to pick out three, four of the chairmen you've known all the time you've been associated with the commission, who were the three or four that you'd say were the most outstanding chairmen, and what were their contributions?
Well, I'd start with Carey. I think he really was the person who established the foundation for insider trading prosecutions and insider trading litigation. That's something that I would give him a great deal of credit for. Manny Cohn also had the great quality of having tremendous knowledge of the historical experiences of the commission, and was largely responsible for the unfixing commission rates. This was under his administration that that program really got going, and he was very effective. It was really an area, too, where there were great strides made in expanding the enforcement area, the injunctions and remedies and all of that, under that area. Casey was also instrumental in some of the areas, but I would say of the two outstanding ones, in my view, are Carey and Cohn. Garrett is probably the other one who I would put in the top three. Garrett came in at a time when, in the history of the commission, it was the first time there had been any scandal at the top. That was with respect to the appointment of Red Cook that had got involved with the Nixon's contributions, the scans, Mitchell, whatever the other third person was. And Garrett really ran a great commission table. He had Al Summer, who was a great lawyer, Phil Loomis, who was a tremendous lawyer, very capable. John Evans, who was a very principled person with an economic background. I think that was a period recognized to have one of the best commissions in the history of the commission when you're talking about the commission as a whole. And Garrett would listen. I mean, remember, he was responsible for my appointment. And so there'd be cases where I would take positions different from his in various matters. For example, let's take on the foreign corrupt practice area and that kind of stuff. Having come from Chicago, Garrett's view was, you know, this goes on all the time, bribery and something like that. You can't get too excited about that. My position was that if you allow that to happen, once you get that corruption, it's going to spread in the organization. You can't have these little things going on without it permeating up the line, and you can't have it at the top going down. But whatever the differences were, it was a pleasure because it was a very excellent discussion, and you had different views, but they would really be considered. So that I think we reached excellent judgments good analysis and stuff in that. And I think that that area was also one in which the commission reputation really took off despite the Brad Cook episode.
Talk about the chairman. Of course, there are five commissioners, usually. Who were some of the, and you mentioned Phil Loomer because he was on the commission and Al Sumner. Who were some of the other commissioners who stand out in your mind who made significant contributions?
I think Bonnie Woodside is one that would stand out. It's unfortunate I don't have all the names in front of me.
You might say a few words about Bonnie.
Well, Bonnie took over from Baldwin Bain, who was the first administrator of the Corporate Finance Division. And Bonnie Woodside had been the person who was directly in charge in Japan of setting up their securities area, so that he had tremendous basic knowledge. But he also had a personality which was very easy to deal with. One thing about the commission when I joined it was there was no hierarchy. You could walk in to Bonnie Woodside's office, a little guy like me who just came in, knew nothing about this area, and present to him your views, and it would be received just as if you had been the top echelon in someplace else. And it was that kind of thing that permeated the commission. Nobody was addressed in Mr. or Mrs. It was always first names, and everybody was on a very low level. Bonnie had a tremendous administrative ability and the knowledge of the operation of the registration process, and also was a good analyst. He knew the business well, so that he was able to. He was also a very calm person. He didn't get excited. He could analyze things and had excellent judgment in reaching his decisions. So he was one of the outstanding people that I recall as commissioner. Trying to think of Owens. Hugh Owens was just a basic guy also with the right feel and the right approach. It was from Texas Gulf that he really wanted to send the people to jail, and it was that kind of reaction that he had. I remember him well. I haven't mentioned Ralph Demler, who was a chairman. The interesting thing about him is that he came in and received a great deal of vitriolic mail about the staff, particularly the general counsel's office. People were writing to him but suggesting they were communists and that sort of stuff. He came in too with the feeling that there was over-regulation, let's say, in the broker-dealer area. And to his credit, after 6 months on the job, when he saw what was going on, he reversed his position from the beginning and understood the need for regulation and was very effective in doing that. And so I think that also did a good job. Trying to think of others. If the names were mentioned to me.
Well, we're going to throw two names at now. Frank Wheat, Jack Whitman.
I think Frank Wheat was a very capable guy. Whitney was a more excitable guy. And Wheat, of course, did the study, institutional study, which was very good. He was a very competent and easy person to deal with. I remember having excellent relationships with him. I always respected him. Whitney, I don't recall anything in the way of a particular program or something that he would push. You take somebody like Smith, I don't remember his first name. And he just was also a little bit like Whitney. I remember when I was trying to get the suitability rule adopted for the CGO, the SEC-only brokers, that must have taken me 6 times to convince him that since the NASD had a rule like that for the brokers, why couldn't you have anything? but a sort of a conservative approach to positions. But, you know, I served under 13, at least 13, I think, different chairman commissions. So at this stage, they all kind of mesh in my life, except for the ones that stand out for particular reasons.
You mentioned UO's connection with Texas Gulf. So why don't we switch to enforcement at the moment? And I think UO sticks in your mind, the Texas Gulf, that he was actually in the chair. Manny Cohn was recovering from his heart attack when the case was actually brought. So why don't we talk about the enforcement area, and why don't you tell me about what you think the most significant cases that you were involved in or took place while you were at the commission, which achieved some change in legal doctrine, not necessarily just the most spectacular cases, well, personalities.
There's no question that Texas Gulf was a seminal case. Not only did it effectively get to the insider trading as an endemic industry, but it also established some of the basic principles. And incidentally, it was Carey who wrote the earlier decision in the insider trading phase that really laid the groundwork. Texas Gulf, we lost in the district court, and we only won it in the Court of Appeals. And that was basically because of Katie Robertson's decision that Carey had written to establish sort of the groundwork for it. The other thing was, inside a trading case, we were attacked by all the economists who claimed that by not allowing this information to get in through the purchases in the market by people who had the inside information, we were preventing the effective market from working, the efficient market from working. So I and others had to go around the country debating that. I had to debate it, I remember, with Abe Fortas, who was representing some people on that position. So I think that opened up a whole area which attacked really the fiduciary obligations of the financial community and how they were abusing their position through insider trading. It was a nefarious, corrupt practice which even today exists. And, of course, we didn't have the statute like they had it today, so we laid the groundwork in Texas Gulf for that. So I would say of all the cases in the civil area, Texas Gulf is the in the other civil area, there weren't individual cases, but we established the restitution, disgorgement, the ancillary remedies, and that was critical. And we pushed that to a bevy well. And I think now you see it's accepted today. In our days, it was heavily litigated whether we were entitled to get that. I remember one commissioner named Adams, who came from New England somewhere, when I presented the first case where I was asking for a receiver, said, where in the statute does it say we can get a receiver? You have an Investment Company Act, you don't have it in any other act, right? And they said, well, look, you know, it's an ancillary remedy. If the court says we can get it, we get it. If the court says we can't, we can't. There's nothing that prevents us from asking for it. And we were successful, of course, in getting it, which is that. But the other remedies had not been used in the early days, if you look. And I don't know why people hadn't thought about it. There was no meat to our injunctions. There was no effectiveness. It just said, don't do it again. So I think that was an effective thing. And I don't remember any specific case that did that. I'd have to go back into the annual reports to know the first ones that we brought that established that principle. In the broker-dealer area, I think the important thing that was accomplished there was we first brought, without any statutory power, the supervision principle, that the people up top had a duty to make sure that their people were obeying the law. And so eventually we were lucky in getting that codified into a statutory provision. So I think that was a very important element. It really put teeth behind the statute in terms of the principles that were involved. One of the things that I think we didn't do effectively, maybe because we didn't get regulatory support for it, was in the markup area. I still think that's an area that we failed to do well. We didn't do much in the penny stock area, and we probably, it was not that important in the totality of what we were dealing with. But I think that's an area which we tried to do later by rule to do something and got opposition because it would be the activities of the other brokers or something. Today they have a better rule on that, but I'm not sure that still isn't a cesspool. And I'm mixing enforcement and other things because you can't really distinguish them too much. I think in the over-the-counter area, which was real cesspool in the 60s, as a result of the special study opening up that area and really giving us a better understanding of it, and the fact of technology, I think the great movement there was in getting the NASDAQ system started. I think that was a really tremendous accomplishment, because I think that gave us the ability to remove all of the secrecy and clandestine activities and all of the fraudulent activities that were going on in the trading markets. In the criminal area, I think first, back under Kerry, and that's too why Kerry in my mind is outstanding. He had the foresight to see there was a deficiency in the way the commission was approaching criminal area and investigative area, that we could all sort of fractionalize. If regions wanted to do a job, they had to ask the office in New York, for example, to do something for the office in San Francisco. Very inefficient. The FBI, incidentally, also did it that way in the years past, and it was the most inefficient system. Kerry saw the need for a more national program. And so when you get the Ray and Ray case in 1960 or 61, he suggests that I should go down and become associate director of the Trading and Markets Division so that we could do more of the enforcement down there with the criminal activity. So I took my assistant...